Good morning. This is Chair Peter Fisher. Pursuant to House Rule 10.01, I call this remote meeting of the Behavioral Health Policy Division to order. I first of all would like to welcome everybody to this first meeting of the Behavioral Health Division Committee. The scope of our purview will be dealing with issues around substance abuse order, addiction issues, and those issues dealing with mental health services. My background is I've spent the last 14 years working in the area of for nonprofits dealing with youth who are experiencing homelessness. A lot of the youth that I've worked with over the years, I've done everything from the finance side to youth advocate to case management. And I've seen a lot of our youth who've dealt with addiction issues, mental health issues, et cetera. So I've had a passion to take a look at how we can better deliver services and make sure people get the services they need to be successful in the future. So my hopes for this committee is that this is traditionally a policy area that there has usually been a lot of bipartisan interest in and collaboration. And because we all understand that there are rising needs across the state of Minnesota, I think that we're going to find a great opportunity for us to be able to work together to help address issues and help continue to build the mental health system that we have out there. A big problem of what we have with people who have got addiction issues, mental health issues, is that we've never properly built a system to take care of and address their needs. And one of the hopes that I have over the next 2 years is as we're working together is be able to advance policies and address the issues out there so that we can start building that system out much more robustly than it is now. I do understand that we're not going to be able to get that done in 2 years. This is something that's going to take longer than that, but I'm hoping that we can get a lot done in the next 2 years to help move that forward. We're hoping that that this committee will also provide space where we can and will hear from every angle of the problems we face, from hearing from patients, from providers, law enforcement, local governments, providers from the health insurance side, those who are doing the frontline services. Want to make sure that we don't leave anybody behind. And some of the topics that I think that we're going to have to address this year, and we're not going to get them all addressed this year. Some of them will go into next year. A critical one that we know that's facing us is the mental health bed shortages in our hospital system. And at the same time, we've got one hospital that is looking at closing 100 of those beds before the year is over. I know that's going to be an issue coming before us. The rise of telehealth services and lessons we learned from COVID-19. What are lessons that we can take from there that are things that have helped make the system work better that we want to make sure we don't lose, making sure we're addressing the advantages and things that we've learned from what telehealth has been able to provide. We want to make sure that we're addressing behavioral health needs in other services too, taking a look as to how it interrelates with education, how does it relate with housing, how does it relate with the criminal justice system. These are some of the other areas, and it could be a possibility at some point that we might have some joint meetings with some of the other committees around here where their areas cross into our areas where we have some joint commonality. And the other thing we want to make sure that as we're taking a look at anything coming through there is making sure we're looking through the racial disparities lens. Is what is anything that we've got coming through, how is it helping address the racial disparities out there to make sure that they don't get any worse than they are now and that we can start making improvements on it? So I want to make sure that as we're doing things, we're also keeping that as a component back there. So these are some of my hopes and dreams for the coming year. I'm excited about everyone who's on the committee. And looking forward to working with everybody. And before we get to our presentation from DHS, I would like to ask our staff and members to introduce themselves. We will start with staff, so I'll call your name and have you briefly tell us your role on the committee and how long you've been with the House. And let's start with our nonpartisan staff. We'll start with Sarah Sutterman.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Sarah Sunderman. I'm from House Research. I have been with the House for, this is my fifth year with the House, and I cover in-house research, mental health, SUD issues, other human services issues, and the health boards.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Ms. Sunderman. Next, let's introduce our nonpartisan staff. We'll start with Mr. Harry Kennedy.
Yes, hello. Good morning, everybody, Mr. Chair and members. Harry Kennedy, I'm with the GOP Staff Caucus researcher, and this is my 11th year at the House.
Thank you, Mr. Kennedy. Next, we'll go to Mr. David Sullivan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is David Sullivan, or Sully. I'm with House DFL Research, and I have been with the House. This will be my 15th legislative session, so since 2007.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Next, we have Mr. Spencer Kroos.
My name is Spencer Kroos. I've been working, it's my fifth year in the House, non-consecutive. I'm working with Rep. Fisher for the last 4 years now. We'll see how this goes. Should be a good time.
Thank you, Mr. Kroos. Next, I have Mr. Chris McCall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chris McCall. I'll be the committee administrator this year. This is my 10th legislative session overall, my third with the House. I previously worked in this issue area as the CA for the Health and Human Services Policy Committee last biennium with Chair Moran.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Mr. McCall. Appreciate it. So now I'd like to have our committee members introduce themselves. I'm going to ask Mr. Kroos to call the roll. And when you hear your name, please introduce yourself with your name, your district, and tell us about the issues you're interested in addressing on this committee. Go ahead, Mr. Kroos.
All right, Frederick.
Hi, Representative Luke Frederick from Mankato. 19B represents Mankato and Eagle Lake. And I've worked at the Security Hospital in St. Peter for 15 years, which is kind of that intersection point between the criminal justice system and the mental health services that the state provides. I've seen a lot of coworkers get pretty badly assaulted, and I want to make sure that the work that we do on this committee, one, it needs to look at the mental health services, but it also needs to look at the staff that work in these places to make sure that their safety is maintained as well, because we can't expect people to be able to provide services if they're also in fear of their own safety at the same time. I look forward to working with this committee. Thank you.
Frankie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Keith Franke, District 54A, Cottage Grove, St. Paul Park, Newport, Great Cloud Island Township. Just excited to be here, excited to be a part of this committee. I've been dealing with working in and around addiction issues and mental health issues for most of my life. So I'm just hoping that, you know, we got a great group of legislators here that come from all different backgrounds and all have a passion to do good things for the state of Minnesota, so, and the people within it. So I think we're going to be able to move a lot of stuff forward, as me and you discussed. I just want to say hi to everybody. Glad to be back and look forward to getting to work and getting some good things done. Thank you.
Backer.
I'm Jeff Backer. I'm representative of 12A, which is the only district that borders both North Dakota and South Dakota. So I'm as far west as you can get in. I live on the hump, bump, tip, elbow, nose on the western part of Minnesota. Reason I'm really interested in this, I have had the opportunity to serve as a volunteer EMT for our ambulance service. It's coming up on 26 years, and we for two small communities, three counties, two states, and then, of course, we where we're at, we do a lot of emergency care for Sisseton Wahpeton Tribe and do a lot of work with them. So I have seen some very, we'll say, interesting and at times very difficult scenarios with picking up patients who are having challenges, and we don't have a good system here in Minnesota. I believe we can have a better system, Chair, and other members. So, and of course, we're the ones that have to do the transporting. A service just next to me had to go from Graceville, Minnesota to Duluth because that was their only bid open. And that's 5.5 hours one way. Ambulance service out, and then our service has to cover that area too, so we just become a larger area. So that's my concern. And then, of course, children in elementary has always been my concern. My first 4 years, I was the chief offer for grants for communities, schools to help children get through and help schools get through some of the behavioral things. So what we do know is if we bite it at the beginning, we have less of these service issues and care issues when they get older. So thank you.
Baker.
Good morning, everybody. And I want to make a challenge to our chair. Chair Fisher, I want to see you be the first chair that gets through a whole committee without mistaking Backer and Baker. It is a very challenging thing to do. We'll keep post of this, but I really appreciate being a part of this and all of my great colleagues that I'm have been working with, and I'm looking forward to meeting some of the new folks and new faces here. Dave Baker, I'm going into my fourth term, small business guy out in Wilmer, Candiota County, which is straight west of Wilmer, straight west of Minneapolis, I'm sorry. My passion has always lied since I began in mental health, addiction support. I worked really hard to get a brand new state-of-the-art children's state hospital out in Wilmer that just opened last year. And really proud to have the CABS Hospital. I think it's actually called something else, and DHS will correct me later. But it's a fabulous new hospital that is ramping up. It takes some time to do that, but we're really proud to have the only state hospital for kids in Wilmer. I want to continue my work there. I'm also the vice chairman now of the OREC group. You'll hear about that at different times. And the OREC group is the Opioid Epidemic Response Advisory Council. Representative Cagle and I sit on that. We've been doing that since day one. We're really happy to serve with Representative Cagle. And you'll see a few things coming from our group. This Opioid Response Council is really made up of, I would say, some of the best professionals around the state of Minnesota address trending issues, not just with opioids, but with all addiction. And it's really an important issue that I hope that we can dive into. We will give you an update at some point about the lawsuits and what's happening with the pharmaceutical companies and their devastation that they did to our communities and our families. Many of you do know that I lost a child to addiction back about 9 years ago, and I'm kind of fighting for my son Dan to help others recognize what addiction is and isn't. It is truly a disease, and it's something that I didn't know when I was going through this with my son. And so my battle now has been to try to explain this to people as best I can, to not shame addiction like so many people think of it that way. But until you're kind of into it, it's really challenging to understand how that works. So, Mr. Chair, members, and I also want to just put out a call out to my new friend a couple years ago, Chris McCall. Chris did a really great job helping us carry House File 400 across the line with my friend, Representative Liz Olson. And so I just really got to know Chris. He worked really hard on that bill to kind of fine tune it and get it through the finish line. So really happy to be part of the team, and I'm looking forward to meeting everybody else. So thank you very much.
Becker Finn.
Thank you. I'm not used to being so down in the alphabetical order. So Jamie Becker Finn, I am in my third term. I represent District 42B, which is some northern Ramsey County cities, including Roseville, part of Shoreview, Little Canada, Vadnais Heights, Gem Lake. But I grew up in northern Minnesota, so I have those connections to rural Minnesota. I am Leech Lake Ojibwe and have those connections to my home community there as well. And I am married to a licensed mental health professional, and so hear firsthand the challenges that folks have, the folks that are trying to do the good work on the front lines of taking care of our friends and neighbors who are struggling. And so that's where my interest is. And I also think this is a really great committee, really like the list of names on this committee. I think we're going to be able to do a lot of good work here, and just really excited for your leadership, Chair Fisher.
Hanson.
Hello, thank you, Chair Fisher and everybody on the committee. I'm Jess Hanson, and I'm representing District 56A, which covers all of the city of Savage and the northwest part of Burnsville down here in the South Metro. I am very excited to serve on this committee. Mental health and barriers to mental wellness have impacted my life for as long as I can remember. I have an undergraduate degree in social work, and so I've spent time in the field working with clients, navigating this system. I'm also serving on the Human Services Committee, so I'm looking forward to the paired work that we can get done here, making sure that every time our systems interact with clients that are seeking these services, that their dignity and worth is upheld, that these services are culturally appropriate and accessible and transparent for everybody to be able to access. I'm looking forward to having the conversations that will destigmatize some of the hardest conversation families are having across the state. In different communities, mental health can be hard conversations to have, harder than in others. And I know that the work that we're going to do here is going to change and hopefully save lives. And so I take this very seriously. I agree with the sentiment that this group of legislators and staff are going to do some really amazing things. So I'm very excited to be here, and I'm looking forward to working with you all.
Katiza Watun.
Good morning, everybody, and thank you. I'm really excited to be here as well. I will echo that. I think I have not yet had the chance to serve on a committee with any of my colleagues that are on this committee, so I think I'm looking forward to getting to know all of you better and working on this important issue together. I serve 48B, which is most of the city of Eden Prairie, and I'm just entering my second term in the Minnesota House. I am a mother of four, so I have my oldest son is going to be seven shortly, and then my youngest son is just over 5 months, so I gave birth over the interim, and I am particularly passionate about postpartum mental health, maternal mental health, and on top of everything, you know, we're working through a global pandemic on top of all the stressors of daily life. So I think that making sure that not only our children have access to the health mental health services that they need, but that it's available and accessible and destigmatized, as some of my colleagues have mentioned, for parents to seek the health, the mental health help that they need. And I just am so excited to learn more from all of you and from the advocates and from the professionals. And I think that we're going to be able to do some really great things.
Lippert.
Hi, everyone. Todd Lippert. I represent District 20B in Southern Minnesota. Montgomery, Lonsdale, Dundas, Northfield area. In my second term, my professional background, I'm a pastor, very concerned about access to mental health care in rural communities. I've been with families as they've been going through a mental health crisis in the emergency room, and a loved one needs treatment, and they're told the closest bed is 6 hours away, as we've already heard. Also have had a brother-in-law that's committed suicide, and my spouse is a licensed social worker specializing in grief and loss and grief counseling. So this is something that is definitely a part of my world, part of my life. And I'm very encouraged by the members of this committee. I'm really excited to work with you and excited to hear how all of our stories and expertise comes together into good policy.
Mahler.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Kelly Mohler, and I represent District 42A, so the other side of Representative Becker-Finn's district. It's Shoreview, Moundsview, Arden Hills, and a little bit of Spring Lake Park. This is my second term, and when I'm not at the Capitol, I'm a prosecutor handling felony appeals, and I've done that work and been in victim rights advocacy for over 20 years now. I, too, am really excited to be on this committee. I can tell by the membership here that we're going to get a lot of great bipartisan work done. So I'm really looking forward to serving with all of you. And I really wanted to be on this committee for both personal reasons and then those that I've seen in my professional capacity. My family lost a close family friend, a teenager, to suicide a few years ago. And on top of that, I've seen just a lack of access for mental health services and chemical dependency access. As being a prosecutor, I have certainly seen how many defendants in our system have had trauma that's not been dealt with, have chemical dependency issues that haven't been dealt with, lack of access to mental health services. And the same for victims, especially victims of violent crime, not having access to the services that they need. So I'm really looking forward to looking at a variety of issues with all of you. Thank you.
Pearson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative Nels Pearson, serving House District 26B. I cover a lot of the rural area in Olmsted County, which surrounds the city of Rochester, Minnesota, and I also have a few other small towns in that district. I've been in the legislature since, for four terms. This is my fourth term. And every term I've served on Health and Human Services. This new committee is obviously what's been covered in past Health and Human Service committees. And so this is certainly something that I'm familiar with professionally and then also personally. You know, we all have our stories about access. And I think that theme throughout this Zoom call is very well known. I think we do need to focus on efficient care, effective care, and the access to that care. And if we can keep those points in mind, we will better serve the citizens of Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thompson.
Well, I'm Representative John Thompson. I represent House District 67A, which covers most of the east side of St. Paul, Payne, Phelan area. Tim Mahoney donned this seat for almost 22 years. So I have some huge shoes to fill. Reason why I actually am interested in this committee here, historically, dehumanization and oppression and violence against African-American people have evolved into what we call this present-day racism, structural and institutional and individual, and it cultivates uniquely mistrustful and less affluent community experience. And the delivery of health care and mental health services in my community are far and in between. Now, I don't know if you guys know this, but I lost my best friend in 2016, Philando Castile, who was murdered. And then I lost my mother a few weeks after that. So everybody said, John, you need to take a break and go see a behavioral health specialist. And I'm like, I'm not crazy. I don't need to sit and talk to nobody. Well, lo and behold, when I went and saw the behavioral health specialist, I told her I was crazy for not coming to see you because all of this compressed down in your body. And as soon as it comes out, they're like, oh, my God, where'd this come from? Here's a normal guy. I definitely wanted to be one of the best fathers that I can be to my son. And so, like, he may ask me for something like that. I just want Burger King. And I'm like, I don't got to, you know what I mean? And all the time it's because of all of this inside. And I don't have a problem, like, admitting that we need behavioral health specialists, not only in our community, we need them in our schools. These kids are walking around every doggone day. They're witnessing shootings. They're witnessing gang violence, police-involved shootings. Our community is going to be in an epidemic after the pandemic. And so I am very passionate about behavioral health specialists, mental health specialists. The one place that I go all the time during the uprising from the George Floyd murder. I'm gonna call it what it is. During the Georgia uprising, I was supposed to see my behavioral health specialist, and she called me on a Thursday and said I can't come because her building was burned down to the ground. One of the places that we need the most in the African American community, burned down to the ground. And so I just want to work with a diverse group of leaders on this, and hopefully bring some resources to the state. But also recognizing that I live in a community that has some culturally specific issues that need to be addressed. Untapped trauma, untapped and undiagnosed trauma turns into hate. And hate untapped is like a wildfire and it just goes everywhere. So I'll leave it there. I look forward to working with you guys on this issue and all the other issues that affect our constituents throughout Minnesota.
Okay, very good. Thank you, everybody, for sharing. I appreciate that. And I want to note for the record that a quorum is present. I have asked the Department of Human Services to provide us with an overview today of behavioral health services that are administered or licensed by the state to help us better understand what mental health and substance use disorder services currently look like in Minnesota. We will have a few presenters, so perhaps they can let us know what is the best, what makes the best sense for pausing for questions as we go through the presentations. So we'll kind of follow the guidance from them. And with that, I'd like to ask, I believe it's going to be Ms. Christy Graum, I apologize for slaughtering the last name there, from the department to introduce herself and our presenters today and start the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Chair members. My name is Christy Graum, and I'm the legislative director for the Community Supports Administration at the Department of Human Services. Community Supports oversees several of our policy areas, including the Behavioral Health Division. So we look forward to spending a lot of time here in this committee with all of you this session, and just really want to extend our gratitude for the opportunity to be here today. Joining me are a few colleagues. So before we jump into the presentation, I'd like to turn it over to them to introduce themselves. But I do quickly want to note that we've collaborated with mental health and substance use disorder stakeholders as we prepare for this presentation today. So the presentation that you're about to see and hear includes input from others beyond just DHS. And many of the stakeholders who've helped us put this together are here to help present and answer questions as well. So with that, I will hand it over to Mr. Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, Matt Burdick. I'm the Director of State Government Relations at the Department of Human Services. I'm with you today, not in my legislative capacity, but as someone with about a decade of experience in behavioral health policy. So looking forward to sharing some of my background and experience with you all as you continue your work throughout this session. And I'll turn it over to Ms. Abderholden.
Thank you, Matt. Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Sue Abderholden. I'm the Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, been here 19 years, and I'm a family member and very pleased to be able to present to you this morning.
Okay.
Should I turn it over to Paul?
Please.
Mr. Fleischner?
Well, I think we were going to go with Dr. Singh first. Dr. Singh, you want to introduce yourself and then I'll jump in.
Thank you. Thank you, Paul. Mr. Chair and members, I am Dr. Neeja Singh. I am the Clinical Director for Community Supports Administration. I have been at DHS for more than 2 years, and prior to my current job, I was working at Behavioral Health Division as their Deputy Director. I work closely with Mr. Fleissner, who is the Director of Behavioral Health Division. So I give it to Mr. Fleissner. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Singh. Thank you, Chair Fisher and members. Good morning. Thank you for this opportunity. Like many of you, I have both a personal and professional passion about behavioral health. My background is I've been in human services for about 36 years. My background is social work and accounting. I've been in Olmsted County for the last 35 years, 27 of them working at Olmsted County running systems, including behavioral health. So I'm very passionate about this area. I've been with the department for a total of 5 weeks. So if I phone a friend during this call, you'll know why. I also happen to be the guardian of my older brother who has mental health needs. So I see this system from a couple different angles, a person who's done social work, a person who has run systems, and a person who has seen the system through my brother's eyes who lives in a different community than I do. So I look forward to working with you. I was very impressed with the passion and expertise of this group, and hopefully as we work together, we can build the system we all dream about for Minnesotans. So with that, we'll kick off the presentation. Thank you. Let's see. Next slide, please. So our agenda today, and we can take questions as we go, we're going to talk about the prevalence of behavioral health issues, historical context, children's mental health services, adult mental health services, substance use disorder treatment services, funding, community supports, system transformation gaps, and coordination with other systems. Obviously, with that many topics, we're covering it at a very high level. And I know that this group might want to dig deeper in some of these things as we move forward. As I think about DHS and our key functions at the Behavioral Health Division. It's important to note that we administer grant programs. The Behavioral Health Division has over 700 different grants that they are responsible for. We use funds designated by the legislature to develop infrastructure for mobile crisis services, a wide range of other services, including respite care, early childhood mental health services, school linked services, culturally specific services, and we support providers' capability to deliver evidence-based practices. In addition, we use the federal block grant and other state appropriated funds to prevent substance abuse, support people experiencing substance use disorder, support people who are homeless or at risk of homelessness, and support justice-involved individuals. We administer grants to address gambling disorders and compliance with laws that prohibit tobacco sales to minors. We serve as the lead on behavioral health policy in our mental health care programs, including benefits policy, rates, and systems. We engage in training to improve culturally and family-oriented services, and we coordinate the development of statewide and local mental health system plans, including statewide goals and objectives. Next slide, please. So some data on the prevalence of behavioral health needs in our state. We have over 182,000 adults with serious mental illness and children with serious emotional disturbance. Those are the folks diagnosed. Keep in mind, as some folks mentioned, it doesn't mean we reach everybody, but it's a fairly high number of folks. There's an estimate across the United States that 5.2% of all U.S. adults with serious mental illness and 65.5% of them receive mental health treatment during the year. 6.5% female and 3.9% male. Nearly $1.2 billion in state expenditures in mental health each year. We had over 64,000 folks who received drug and alcohol addiction treatment. 68% white, 32% BIPOC and other. Primary substance use included 38% alcohol, 27% methamphetamine, and almost 35% injectable drugs and other opiates. The next slide will show you a little bit more detail on that. Next slide, please. So obviously alcohol is the top drug of choice that we see in treatment, but methamphetamine comes in second if you pull apart some of the opiate use. So, for example, methamphetamine comes in second, injectable drug use third, heroin fourth, and then other opiates last. Next slide. So in terms of receiving treatment and who pays for treatment, based DANES, in case you're not familiar with that term, is our database around reporting for these services. Private pay is about a little under a third, so cash and insurance. Public pay through what used to be called our Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund. What we really call that now is our Behavioral Health Fund, so that's old language, but it was also about a third. And public pay through our Minnesota healthcare programs and contracted managed care organizations is another third. Next slide.
In 1960, there were over 10,000 people with mental illnesses in Minnesota state hospitals, and there really were no community services. Using the report from the Eisenhower Administration's Commission on Mental Illness and Mental Health, President Kennedy challenged our country in 1962 to build a community mental health system, saying that the hospitals were, quote, understaffed, overcrowded, unpleasant institutions from which death too often provided the only firm hope of release. 1 year later, the Community Mental Health Act passed, creating community mental health centers, kind of one-stop shops for treatment and supports in the community. Unfortunately, the funding was limited, and President Nixon cut the funding, and then President Reagan cut the funding and turned it into a block grant to the states with few strings attached. Despite the lack of funding for community services, the state hospitals were emptied. By 1978, only 1,200 people with mental illnesses were left in the institutions, and by 2000, just a few hundred. With Medicaid having the IMD exclusion, which is where Medicaid won't pay for any facility of more than 16 beds, where more than half of the people are being treated with a mental illness or substance use disorder, Medicare actually having a lifetime limit on the number of inpatient psychiatric bed days and not paying for every type of mental health professional, and also our private insurance not paying for mental health and substance use disorder treatment like other healthcare conditions, the reality is our system isn't broken. It was never built. There weren't funds to develop community services. Excuse me. Parity was passed in Minnesota law in the 1990s and then the federal level in 1996 and a stronger version yet in 2008. Please note that parity does not require health plans to cover mental health and substance use disorder treatment. It just says if you do, you have to do it in the same way. Can't have different out-of-pocket costs, can't have different treatment limits, and we have what's called non-quantitative treatment limits, which means you're supposed to be treating the services, drug formularies, and things like that the same. Although I will still say that private insurance won't cover new psychiatric residential treatment facilities. In Minnesota, the Mental Health Legislative Network, which is a coalition of over 40 organizations, formed in 1984 and has worked with DHS for 40 years to build the mental health system. In 1976, there were zero funds for community mental health, and by 1990, it was about 90 or 40 million. In 1987, the Adult Mental Health Act was passed, and 2 years later, the Children's Mental Health Act, which really laid out what our mental health system should look like and clearly created a state-supervised, county-administered system. One caveat is that the system was to be developed within available appropriations. In 2001, we saw a very large investment, especially for crisis housing. But a huge change was made in 2006 and 2007, and that was called the Mental Health Action Group. And their initiative moved many grant and county-funded services and treatments, such as assertive community treatment teams, adult rehab mental health services, and children's therapeutic services and supports to Medicaid and Minnesota Care, and then created new grant programs to fund school-linked, crisis services, and respite care. There were other monumental years when the legislature increased funding for mental health, such as 2013 that focused on children due to Sandy Hook happening in December of 2012. And again, for both systems, adult and children in 2015 and 2019. There have been many policy issues in addition to funding increases that have helped build our mental health system, such as changes to the Commitment Act, creating psychiatric residential treatment facilities, including family and peer specialists in our workforce, creating certified community behavior health centers, and first episode programs. Over the years, we have worked together to increase access, ensure our providers are viable, and address workforce shortages. There have been over 20 studies conducted on our mental health system. Commissioner Levine in Governor Perpich's administration said back in the late 80s, "We don't need more studies. We know the problems. What we need is action." So we know what works. We just need to finish building our system. I just wanted to briefly say that Minnesota has long been looked as a leader in addiction treatment and care. It's home to the Minnesota model, which emphasizes an abstinence approach and with a team of people supporting the person in treatment. In the 1980s, Minnesota continued its leadership by creating the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund, which pays for the treatment for people who don't have money to do that. The Substance Use Disorder Reform effort passed in 2017 sought to develop a recovery-oriented system of care that expanded the continuum of services, created reimbursement for activities such as peer recovery support and treatment coordination, and reduced barriers to accessing treatment through a means called direct access.
Mr. Chair and members, I am going to be building on what Ms. Eberholden just talked about, like having to build a system where we meet the needs of our people where they are. I'm sure, like I was listening to all the members talking about their passion and for passion for behavioral health, it is clear that behavioral illnesses, they do not occur in vacuum. We are dealing with the whole individual. We are dealing with the whole community, including family, their peers, when we are designing this continuum of care system. Mr. Chair and members, I would ask you to think about Maslow's need hierarchy model, where, you know, it is like ranging from the very basic needs of food, shelter, water, to going to all the way to self-actualization, where people need support to realize their full potential. And that is what we have tried to do when we are in the process of building this continuum. As you will see, primary care is one of the major partners for behavioral health system. We would want our providers, behavioral health providers, to be working hand in hand with primary care providers. Then comes housing. Mr. Chair and members, homelessness is often a manifestation of untreated or undiagnosed or unacknowledged mental illness symptoms. Or it is one of the causes of creating very adverse life experiences, which often lead to behavioral health crisis. Substance use disorders, we will be talking about the model that Minnesota, which Ms. Everholden just talked about, Minnesota model. And again, it is the integrated care where we have primary care, where we have mental health and substance use, all integrated to treat the whole individual and the family. We acknowledge education and we acknowledge the intense trauma our children and their teachers and their parents are going through. So Community Supports Administration is working closely in addressing those mental health concerns in our school settings and design some programs, which we will be talking as we go along. Employment is one of the, again, going back to Maslow's need hierarchy, Mr. Chair. Employment is one of the very important aspects that our people need for their self-esteem, for their self-adequacy, as well as to meet the basic needs. So we work closely with our partners from BEAD and other agencies to make sure that our mentally ill clients, as well as our clients who are suffering from substance use disorder, get this support. Transportation, that is huge. How am I going to get to my treatment? Do I have gas? Do I have car? Do I even have car insurance? Is there like a driver who can drive me to my appointment if I need? And on top of it, we have our single parents who are struggling right now to meet their end need and who have multiple needs of their children related to their mental health. So all these factors really needs to be taken into account when we are building this mental health continuum that Ms. Everholden was just talking about. Mr. Chair, criminal justice system, I am so glad that members pointed out a majority, and I don't have the exact numbers here, but a majority of our people in criminal justice system have, again, unacknowledged, undiagnosed, untreated behavioral health crisis, which again, sometimes are the reasons that they are engaging in risky behaviors. So it is very important for us to work with criminal justice system in addressing those needs. And as I talk, I'll kind of talk more about how we are partnering with criminal justice system and how we plan to do it more. Behavioral health crisis is a public health crisis, Mr. Chair and members. That including the huge implications of systemic racism, which is impacting behavioral health of our members. We need to start seeing this as a public health crisis. This is an epidemic. And that's why we need to work closely with all social services, child protection, child safety and permanency, employment, I mentioned, to make sure, again, that we are building a continuum where we are bringing services to the people rather than expecting our people to come and look for what is needed. Next slide, please. Mr. Chair and members, I'm glad that some of the members mentioned the intense need of building a continuum for our children. Children are our most precious as well as most vulnerable human resource. that is true for the whole world. And I'm sure we all have heard that it takes a village to raise a child. We are in the process. And again, these services are existing, but I'm not going to claim that they are really meeting every need every child in Minnesota has. We have tried to build, and we continue to refine this continuum, which is on the screen for you all. We are trying to build this continuum with focus on families, as well as with emphasis on cultural responsibility. Because as we know, we cannot continue to provide one size fit all, given the changing face of our demographics and changing needs of our children. We have outpatient therapy, Mr. Chair and members, which is, again, if a child shows the need and we determine the need via a process which is called a diagnostic assessment, that is based on some scientific tools, scientific behavioral health tools, to determine the need. And based on that need, the services are designed for that specific child and family. So outpatient therapy is where the child and the parent meets with the therapist, the behavioral health specialist, depending on what the need is, once, twice a week. We are extremely proud of the work we did with our partners who are in this meeting on bringing and continue to build our infrastructure for schooling to mental health services. Majority of these services are provided, Mr. Chair, in collaboration with our school teachers as well as our school staff. And I'll talk about it when we come to the realities of pandemic, but we were able to work with our partners at the federal level as well as at the state level to make sure that these services are continue to be provided even when the schools were like virtual. Children's therapeutic services and supports, that is another model of care that we provide to our children when they manifest needs. And there are like multiple services under CTSS, which range from individual therapy, group therapy, family therapy, and then skills training. Because a lot of times our children need some coaching, some training in developing certain skills. So this program is designed to provide that. Sometimes our kids would need more than what I just talked about, like once or twice a week of therapy, check-in, skills training. And that's why we have programs like day treatment or partial hospitalization. That's when children are coming to these programs 3 to 4 times a week, getting multiple services, but they are staying in the community. So we really need to build and expand these programs, again, with the cultural responsiveness in mind to make sure we are able to mitigate the risk of our children being placed out of home for multiple reasons. Youth Assertive Community Treatment Service, that is a program to meet the needs of children and youth who are showing signs of higher mental health need. For example, like a 16-year-old showing signs of schizophrenia or some issues with connection to the reality. However, if the child or the youth has strong support from social connections, do not need to be admitted to the hospital level of care, that's where youth assertive community treatment intensive comes. These services are provided under the care of a psychiatrist, a child and adolescent psychiatrist, who oversees the provision of the treatment plan to these clients. Psychiatric residential treatment facilities, that is a new model. We are, and these facilities are excluded from IMD status. So these facilities are hospital level care, but they are not hospitals, where children under 21 who are manifesting need for more intense residential level of care are provided that care. These facilities, again, are built on heavy focus on family involvement, and PRTF model in Minnesota has three state agencies involved, which is MDH, Minnesota Department of Health, DHS, as well as MDE, Minnesota Department of Education. So, and these facilities follow the norms which are set by CMS, Center for Medicare and Medicaid. We have, on top of this, we have hospital level of care. Hospitals do provide care to our children and youth when they are having mental health crisis and need that intense care. We have children's residential facilities in Minnesota, and that's, again, where the need is demonstrated through the assessment that this child needs more than what a community-based program can provide, then we go to residential care. Intensive treatment and foster care, that is a Medicaid paid benefit, Mr. Chair and members. And again, that is a very much evidence-based model, and it is designed, again, to mitigate the risk of out-of-home placement or out-of-community placement for our children. So in this model, children are placed in specialized foster home. And a lot of times when I say the word placed, I mean like in clinical sense, because a lot of times we work with parents, like the providers work with biological parents to provide services to their children through intensive treatment foster care. And then while in this setting, our children are getting intense mental health and substance use services. We have mobile crisis across the state, and our teams comprise of a mental health professional. We have recently started the process of adding a licensed alcohol drug counselor in our mobile crisis teams. And again, these crisis teams are designed to provide immediate help to a client in Minnesota who is in behavioral health crisis. And across all these services, Mr. Chair and members, we have targeted case management. These services are designed, targeted case management services are designed to connect all these pieces and provide resources to the child and the family to make sure that their needs are met. Next slide, please. Mr. Chair and members, very much like what I talked about, the children's continuum of care, mental health care, we have adult mental health continuum. Again, I would say that there is a lot of work that needs to be done in these services, especially around access, around increasing quality, as well as ensuring that we have equity and cultural responsiveness imbibed in all of these services. These services are, we have tried to design and refine these services based on developmental spans. So as again, somebody in Minnesota has mental health needs, they go through an assessment, and that assessment decides or recommends the intensity and frequency of treatment that that person would benefit from. Outpatient therapy is very much like the same model. They can get individual, group, family services under this model. Then we have adult rehabilitative mental health services. And I'm not going to kind of say that this is equivalent to CTSS, but the concept is in children's world, but the concept is to provide skills, provide resources to somebody who is right on that verge of getting, meeting the need for mental health services. We have mobile crisis, very much like children's services across the state for our adult clients. In fact, we have more support for adult clients than for children. Our day treatment and partial hospitalization services are the same as I talked about the children, that somebody who needs more than once or twice a week, they can benefit from this service. Assertive community treatment, which is called ACT, this is again for our adult clients who are manifesting the need for more intense psychiatric care. Very much like Youth ACT, these services are provided under the care of a psychiatrist there is a team like a therapist, a mental health, a behavioral analyst, a peer specialist, a family therapist who are working closely around this client and family to make sure their needs are met. our hospitals provide mental health care, and again, like the need for beds, and that raises the question of access is like an ongoing concern, especially during pandemic. We also have state-operated programs, which is like our Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, community behavioral health hospitals, and Minnesota Specialty Health Systems. Target case management, very much like on the children's side, these services are supposed to support the client to access the resources as simple as transportation to get to these services. I will pause for any questions, Mr. Chair, or members, if anyone has right now.
Okay, I'm not seeing any questions right now, Ms. Singh. Why don't you go ahead and continue on?
Thank you. In our efforts to build an integrated system of care for people in Minnesota, we are trying to follow the same continuum of services on mental health side, which are on the mental health side in our substance use disorder treatment. Somebody, again, who is manifesting a need or concerns regarding use of substances, which is interfering in their functioning, they can be referred for an assessment, which is done by a professional who is licensed in alcohol and drug counseling. And then based on that assessment, a treatment plan is developed, which will determine the recommendations for what sort of treatment this person would need. The same outpatient level of care is available. And then we have residential level of care with like low, medium, high, and also committed complex. These low, medium, and high, Mr. Chair and members, are based on the number of hours, that is the frequency of services, which is recommended in that assessment that is done for that client. Community Supports Administration is looking, with our community partners, is looking at redefining and redesigning this continuum, low, medium, and high, given the needs have changed, the demographic aspects have changed, and also the whole philosophy of having to treat integrated person that would include their mental health and physical health. So we are trying to redesign and review these hours. Then we have another caveat here, which is called committed complex. These are for the clients who are committed to the commissioner of DHS. We have our withdrawal management and detox services, which are for clients who are manifesting concerns regarding when experiencing withdrawal. These services are again provided under the guidance of a medical doctor. They have licensed alcohol drug counselors, and also treatment coordination plays a huge role, and we are trying to build that service as we move along to make sure that somebody who goes to withdrawal management is also connected with services like outpatient therapy or other levels of care. Opioid treatment programs. These programs are designed, again, to deal with consistently rising opioid crisis. And I will talk more about it, and I'm sure we'll kind of talk in our other hearings about the challenges we are having with our OTT programs right now. And we will be looking at our committee, the Opioid Council, that Representative Baker talked about, for working closely with them for some recommendations. Integration of substance use disorder and mental health, that has been an ongoing effort. While working on treatment, Mr. Chair and members, we are heavily focused on prevention activities for substance use disorders. Tobacco prevention and compliance is our venture, working closely with federal government on preventing the sale of tobacco to minors in Minnesota. On top of it, like collaborating with our community partners and our federal guiding resources to identify role of untreated mental health factors in leading to these risky behaviors that somebody engages in that includes tobacco as well as problem gambling. We are looking forward to continue to build our peer recovery support services because, again, these services are acting as a bridge for somebody who is going for substance use treatment. It requires a lot of courage, given the stigmatization our clients with substance use disorder face. So peer recovery support services, Mr. Chair and members, are designed to be provided by someone who has lived through the experience as well and now is trained to provide support and, again, more like a reality check to our clients as they are making commitments and huge decisions regarding their recovery and mental health. Our hospitals also provide, again, there are concerns and significant deficits in terms of beds, but our hospitals do provide hospital level of care. Behavioral Health Fund, that is the new name for CCDTF, what Mr. Fleisner just mentioned in his introductory presentation. That is the new name for CCDTF, and there are multiple factors which were considered while designing Behavioral Health Fund, and one of those were to encourage our county partners to support their citizens to get on Medicaid. Because clients who are on Medicaid, counties do not have to pay their share. They don't have to pay their share. Whereas for CCDTF, that is for the clients who are not eligible for Medicaid, counties still have to pay their share in the treatment. So this fund was kind of envisaged to encourage our county partners to support their citizens to get on Medicaid and also to have like a uniform rate across the housing support for mental health and substance use. Any questions?
Yes, I've got a question, Ms. Singh. Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm a little confused as we're talking about the addiction issue versus the mental health. I thought I heard earlier on that not all health plans will necessarily cover, say, mental health services. Does that also apply in the addiction issues here? When you have addiction, do all health plans have to cover it, or do they cover that same as mental health? Because I keep on hearing the reference to Medicaid. So I'm assuming Medicaid covers these things. So I could use a little help in clarifying how that process all ties through there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, Medicaid covers these things. And you are absolutely right that our health plans, our commercial health plans do not always cover substance use, very much like they do not always cover mental health. It is an ongoing process given the Parity Act and Affordable Care Act that they cannot deny somebody a treatment for pre-existing mental health or substance use disorder conditions. But at the same time, it is an ongoing process. So yes, they do not always cover substance use disorders.
So, Ms. Singh, is if the private plans don't cover it, what happens then? Do the people have to pay for it themselves, or is that how they some of them may end up on medical assistance?
Yes, that's what is happening, Mr. Chair. And but Medicaid should be the payer of last resort. So that is like an ongoing work we are doing, and our colleagues from Healthcare Administration who are responsible for negotiating contracts with our insurances help a lot in that. But yes, that is one of the disincentives that people have for seeking treatment when their insurances would kind of put some limits around what they can and what they cannot do.
Do we have an idea how many private how many insurance plans out there, or what percentage of people have got insurance but do not have coverage for addiction and mental health services?
We can try, Mr. Chair, and get that data. I don't know how accurate that would be, but we will try to get that as soon as possible. We'll have to collaborate with our partners in healthcare, but we will.
Mr. Chair, you are currently muted.
Thank you. Thank you. Ms. Abbott-Holden, I see your hand up. If you'd like to go ahead, please.
Mr. Chairman, I'll just mention that it's that's very difficult data to get because often people don't know that the service or treatment that they want is not covered by their insurance. And when you're in the middle of a crisis like that, you don't think, I'll call the Department of Commerce or I'll call the U.S. Department of Labor. People often don't know if they have a self-insured plan or a plan that's regulated by the state of Minnesota. So it's very difficult data to get.
Okay, thank you for that additional information. But would it be possible, though, for the to know what percentage of plans there are out there that don't offer that? You know, I think that would be that would be somewhat helpful. Go ahead, Ms. Abderholden.
Most plans will now anyway cover it. And of course, any plans that are offered through the exchange have to cover it. So individual and small group policies. The bigger issue is what we call the non-quantitative treatment limits. Are you covering the same type of care that you cover under healthcare? Is your drug formulary more limited? Is the medical necessity requirements more stringent? Those are the bigger issues than just do they cover it at all? And it's more complicated then.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Yes, and if I'm understanding correctly, that's where when we're talking about parity, this is the issue that we're talking about when we're talking about parity then. And I see your head nodding up and down. Thank you for helping clarify that. And I'm not seeing any other hands raised at this point, so why don't we go ahead with the continuation of the presentation there. It would be Ms. Singh that would continue here, or is there another person starting up?
Right now, Mr. Chair, it's me, and then I will pass it on to my friend, Mr. Fleitner. Can I have other slides, please? I'll briefly talk about the funding resources, which Ms. Abderholden just mentioned, so private insurance. I will not go in detail, but we will try to get you what we have, Mr. Chair, in terms of the data. Medicaid is our primary source of funding, and on top of it, a lot of behavioral health services are covered through federal and state grants, which we will be talking about either in this presentation or in future. And Mr. Fleissner, I'm sure he will talk about the overall strategic vision he has for managing the grants, because I'm sure the members and Mr. Chair, you guys are aware that there will be a report coming on identifying some of the concerns regarding the grant management process in the behavioral health division. So we manage, BHD manages more than 700 grants right now, which is like the maximum in any division in DHS. So a lot of these grants cover our mental health and substance use services across the state of Minnesota. With that, I am going to be transferring to Mr. Fleissner. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Singh. Chair Fisher and members. Yeah, I'm going to jump right into the OLA report that's about to come out to you. Now, I've been with the department for about 5 weeks. One of the things that I'm there to do is figure out how do we build a system that that works better in terms of some of the things you're going to hear about in the OLA report. One of the things that I want to really recognize in my first 5 weeks is I don't think it's about the people. I think there is amazingly talented people in the behavioral health division. That has struck me. What I think has happened, and maybe a little history here, a few years ago, we combined children's mental health, adult mental health, and the ADAD, which was substance use, into one division. But in doing so, we really didn't build a culture. There were multiple processes that were different. There was different finance, grant management, contracting, and we threw it all together. We didn't necessarily build a culture that was consistent across our business operations. And so it's like building a house. If you don't build a good foundation, it gets pretty wobbly pretty quickly. And at least in the first 5 weeks, I will tell you that the root cause is not the people. It's how do we give the people the right tools? Before I got there, Commissioner Harpstead, Assistant Commissioner Matema Mutasa had already started a lot of work. And one of the things that Dr. Singh mentioned is we have over 700 contracts that represent just short of $500 million. but those different policies, different procedures, different business processes, there's huge disconnects, and I've already seen them in the work that we're doing. The finance, grants, process, and contracting aren't well connected, and yet we have people trying to manage all this without the proper tools. So what is happening? We are mapping these processes. We're fixing where we have broken handoffs and other things going on. We're also looking at how do we integrate and streamline that workflow across grants, contracts, and financing. In our administration, they hired a chief administrative officer, Jennifer Yang, and she's doing yeoman's work documenting those processes. And then we're looking at automating good processes. And the first place we're going to start is the Behavioral Health Division, because we're the ones who tripped over ourselves in terms of getting timely dollars out the door, contracts in place, those sorts of things. My commitment to you is we're on it. I think the staff are committed to doing a great job. I'm committed to getting them the right tools so that we're accountable to you. We're accountable to the providers and advocates that are on this call with us because they get impacted. And I want to say counties who are the local behavioral health authorities for us also are impacted. And so it's my commitment that we'll come back with progress reports to you so you understand after you get a chance to see the report what the issues were, what has been done about it so far, and what progress we're making. In terms of the actual change, we're going to start piloting our new process in a few months, and so with some of our contracts to make sure we work out the kinks before we go to the whole enchilada. So I want you to know there's a plan. We have the right people, and we are going to serve Minnesota the right way going forward. So I will jump into the other pieces that we're talking about here. Community supports. I think some folks have already talked about how we need to weave things together. Nobody can stay sober or their mental health stable without the basic needs. As Dr. Singh mentioned, weaving these things together are critical. I can tell you with the housing barriers we have all over this state, it's a game changer. One of the advantages I had in Olmsted County is we had integrated the housing authority. One of the first things that we were able to do is master leasing for people who had barriers. So when we think about walking alongside people who are recovering and really taking a healthcare approach, one of the first things that we can do is remove that kind of barrier. If they are housed, they can go to treatment. They can keep their jobs. They can stay connected or stay with their families. And so that's a really important piece. Targeted case management, which works across many of our systems, is really a connector to all those services. Dr. Singh is going to talk about waivers and personal care and those things.
Excuse me, if we could take a break there. I know that Representative Baker has his hand up with a question. Representative Baker, if you'd like to go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I could wait till the end. I was going to ask a little bit more about the legislative audit that Mr. Fleshner had brought up. Maybe again, as I've not seen it yet, or I think it's coming out soon. I've been kind of given some heads up about what's in it. I think as a legislator who's been here for a while, we do know that there's been some pretty substantial granting errors, if you will, in the last few years. And I will tell you that as part of that OREC group, we have been painfully trying to make sure we don't make those same kind of mistakes with that opioid council, because it is complicated when you start granting out money. I do appreciate the work of DHS and trying to get their arms around this. I think the leadership of Commissioner Harpstead has actually been pretty darn good. And I know that there's been a lot of internal changes. So Mr. Fleshner, one of the things I wanted to just comment on as you enter into this world of getting this fixed up and getting it stood up right so we all have better credibility with our granting programs, is I think you have to look at some of the people and the people that were there to help us, the legislators, to get it right too. So as we keep layering and on after the layer of years of changing and doing this, we need to count on people that will say, stop for a minute, we aren't getting this right. But at some point, we cannot just keep protecting the people that have been making those mistakes over the years. I say that because our taxpayers are demanding accountability. We're demanding accountability on every level of federal and state government right now. So I want to make sure, before we completely jump in front of defending every employee that is there, we've got to admit there's been some mistakes made. And I hope that that's part of your overall plan. And I know there's great people at DHS, and I've seen them, and I've worked with them, but I want to just say that because I think it's important to honestly address this directly. And if there is that addressed, I think it gives a lot of, I think, credibility then to your delivery of this to say there is ownership on other levels too. So I wanted to make that statement, and I hope I'm being respectful by that, but it's a big picture. We're here to support you and getting it done right, but I want to make sure we have everything on the table.
Thank you. Chair Fisher and Representative Baker, yes, one of the things that we have to be is we all have to be accountable, and people have been held accountable. For example, when we make one of those errors, it's called a 16A C or C violation, people are held accountable, and that is reflected in their performance or other things that happen within our HR system that, you know, I'm not going to get into here. So there is a sense of accountability. But I have to tell you, having worked in systems and run a lot of contracts and budgets over the years, we really, truly do need to give people a chance to have the right tools in place and then truly hold them accountable, because there's no more rationale for not getting it right. And so I want to blend the two. And I've never been shy of holding people accountable, even at a department head level in my previous work. So my commitment to you is people will be held accountable, including me, if we don't get it right.
Representative Baker, any other questions that you have?
No, that's it for now, Chair. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Representative Baker. Mr. Fleischner, if you'd like to continue, please.
Certainly. I think it was handing it off to Dr. Singh on waivers.
And I'll briefly check. I know we don't have a lot of time, so we want to leave time for questions. Right now, we have two waivers in place, which is like our CCBHCs, Certified Community Behavioral Health Clinics, and also our 1115 Substance Use Disorder Waiver. We are really excited about both of these ventures, CCBHCs, like I'm sure you guys have heard about it. 1115 is a new venture. It is working right now, and we are working with our stakeholders and providers. And that waiver will make sure that our people in Minnesota are getting the care, which is evidence-based, designed on ASM, American Psychiatry of Addiction Medicine standards. That is up and running. That is like getting to be up and running, and we will come back with more reports on that. Next slide. Please.
I wonder, you kind of covered this, Dr. Singh. I wonder if we should move to the next slide and I'll take it. Or do you want to cover telemedicine?
Perfect.
Okay.
I can briefly, I know telemedicine, go ahead.
Sorry, I'm trying to fit in time for questions. So I'm jumping ahead to coordination with other systems, because I want to talk about, we need to create new front doors for our system. A lot of the folks that end up in our with substance use disorder or mental health issues still end up in our jails, in law enforcement systems, juvenile detention centers, and our emergency departments. We have to weave together these other services to prevent that from happening, and we have to have different kinds of responses. I know in Southeast Minnesota, Senator Senjum led an effort to get a crisis center in place that will be our new front door. And I think things like that, partnering with peer recovery specialists to understand where we need new services and building that on the front end so that people with lived experience are defining our services is critical. And then having the right resources in place, the integration across these systems, it really does make a difference. For example, We talked about certified community behavioral health clinic. I've experienced those on two levels. In Olmsted County, we had one at Zumbro Valley Health Center where all the substance use, all the mental health, all the housing, dental, primary care, employment are in one place. It makes a big difference to people. My brother, who I'm guardian for, has a similar resource in his community. Those are the kinds of things that we have to build out with you to experience a different outcome, I think, for people. We also have to, in my opinion.
Excuse me, Mr. Fleschner. Hold, I see a couple hands going up here from Representative Thompson and Representative Becker-Finn.
Sure.
What I'd like to do is, why don't we pause real quick here? I want to check with them if we can knock the questions out quickly and try to finish up the presentation. Then I'll start off with Representative Thompson. Representative Thompson, I see your hand up with a question. You can go ahead.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
I can hear you now.
In DHS, they have these health and human service waivers, and they kind of demonstrate administrative efficiency and improve outcomes and service delivery. My question, will you continue those? And then the other question I had, just off the record, I was just, just on the record, I was reading here, what isn't overpayment of approximately $9 million in Medicaid funds for chemical health services. That's whole counties harmless for that overpayment? Those are just two questions I have. Because I wanted to continue with the presentation. I just wanted to put that in there.
On the waiver question, the waivers are tied to a request through the federal government, so they are usually time limited, or sometimes they get in place for long periods of time. And then on the other question, yes, those dollars that you're talking about, those overpayments, I do believe counties were held harmless on those overpayments, and the state found another way to cover that.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Paul. Representative Paul.
You're welcome. Next, Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I can wait till the end. I just wanted to make sure I was on the list since we're short on time.
Okay, thank you, Representative Becker-Finn. I'll have you first on the list as soon as the presentation is done. Mr. Fleschner, if you'd like to go ahead, and I'll hold off any other questions until we get to the end of the presentation then.
Sure. Because of the lack of time, I think we'll move on to the gaps, which is our last slide, and then we can entertain questions because I know there's we want to have a dialogue. So next slide, please. So we have a gap in crisis services. We do not have enough across the state. As we've already talked in this conversation, we don't have enough beds either, kids or adults, and we're losing them on the adults case. And I know that we have kids that end up, and occasionally adults, that have to actually go to other states for services. And I think it is my hope that we can do better than that. The opioid crisis is obviously testing our system, and we're still trying to figure out the best way to serve people. And it's really critical that as we think about inequitable access, we're building services, but are we building the right services in the right places where we have gaps? And I think that's something we need to explore with this committee. With that, I was going to turn it over to Dr. Singh to wrap us up.
Thank you, Mr. Fleschner, Mr. Chair, and members. Not taking a lot of time, we don't have a lot left. I would like to kind of mention, besides the fact that we really need to build a continuum of care or redesign our continuum of care with focus on cultural responsiveness, as one size does not work for everyone. We have workforce shortages in Minnesota, very much like the rest of the country, so that needs to be addressed. And on top of everything, Mr. Chair, pandemic has posed unique challenges for our providers as well as our clients. And this is like a unique situation where our providers are suffering the same way their clients are, but they are responsible for taking care of their clients while they are dealing with the realities of pandemic themselves. And that's why the need for looking at the behavioral health rates across the continuum is very important. And we have our community partners here, I don't know if somebody would have a few minutes to talk about it, but we need to look at the behavioral health rates to make sure our providers are able to sustain high quality service for the enrollees. Uniform service standards, that seems to be like an answer to a lot of our issues with duplication of paperwork as well as certification and licensing. I'll just kind of leave you with one comment that within our statute and law, Mr. Chair, we have 47 definitions of mental health professional. So you can well imagine like our public, when they are trying to see, okay, what does it say about a mental health professional? There are 47 ways it is defined. And uniform service standards, it is a venture which involves active stakeholder engagement. Our stakeholders have done a phenomenal job in collaborating. We are hopeful that once implemented, USS will be able to help a lot of those duplication concerns and confusing concerns. With that, I'm going to open it for questions.
Okay, thank you very much. We will start off. We've got about 4 minutes here. I will start off with Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one thing I wanted to touch on is the sort of the disconnect between DHS and MDH. You know, so we, on the one hand, we talk about parity and how this is a health issue. And then on the other hand, all the licensing happens on the DHS side. And so wondering what is being done about that. I know as an example, when it's come to the vaccine rollout, the siloing of those two things has become really obvious in, you know, the MDH is making the recommendations based on the DHS licensing, but the folks at MDH don't seem to truly understand the difference of those different facilities on that continuum of care and what those things actually look like as far as what the you know kind of face-to-face services look like and how those programs operate in a community. And so I'm wondering if you can speak to, you know, is this something that you're aware of and you know, what are you doing about that? Because it's kind of a theme that I've seen again and again with that disconnect with two different agencies kind of overseeing different pieces of this. So if you could speak to that, I'd really appreciate it.
Well, you know, as I said, I've been here 5 weeks. Now, from my perspective, I think one of the things coronavirus has done is shown a lot of our weaknesses, and that would be one of them. How do we have that kind of disconnect? In my mind, it tells us we need to have those two areas speaking to each other, understanding their basic needs. I know one of the things that I think will help with that, our deputy assistant commissioner in our area, Doug Annett, has been deployed a lot to public health. So I think we have some bridges to doing different kinds of work. But until we get through the pandemic, I'm not sure we can fix big system issues immediately. But I think he's been our bridge in working on some of those kinds of barriers. But maybe others who have been there can speak to that as well.
And I'm going to interrupt at this point as I'm seeing we've got about 2 minutes left. And I see that Representative Keith Franke also has his hand up. So Representative Franke, if you'd like to go ahead, this will be the last question as we don't have much more time. And if we have more questions coming up, if we could get them forwarded to Chris McCall, and then you can follow up with the appropriate people to get answers that people may need out there. Representative Franke, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, everyone. I want to thank everyone for the time they put into this presentation. Obviously, we have a lot of work to do, and there's a lot of subjects, and this is a big thing to delve into. I'll run through some quick questions, some information that I could potentially get, and then Mr. Chair, if me and you could chat offline. I know that there's probably a lot of unanswered questions we just really didn't have time to get to. Mr. Fleischer, you spoke about 700 contracts and 700 grants, roughly. Now, those are two separate situations, am I correct?
No, I was blending the two. That's 700 grants. I can't remember exactly how many contracts we have. Sorry, Representative Franke, that was my error.
All right, thank you, Mr. Fleischer. Can I get a list of all of those? just kind of to see where all that's going. Also, just briefly, the 47 definitions of the healthcare professionals, can we get a list of all of those definitions? That might be something that we might be useful to the whole committee. And then a little more info on the waivers, if I could get that. And that would just be my quick questions. Once again, I want to thank everybody. Obviously, there was not enough time, I'm sure, for a lot of questions, but hopefully we can get back to this. So thank you, everybody. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Franke. I appreciate that. And everyone for being on the meeting today. I think some of this may, if we've got some other things that maybe we can have the questions sent over and we can try to get some of the information out at our next meeting. I want to thank you to our presenters for their time today. Thank you, members, for your participation in this first hearing. Next week, we're going to have a discussion also about the impact of the pandemic on Minnesota's behavioral health needs out there. I think this goes to some of the questions that were starting to come up, as well as some of the lessons we learned over the last year that could help us to reimagine how we deliver services going forward. Once again, thank you, everyone, for being here. And with that, we are adjourned.